Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thank you for downloading this Intelligence Squared podcast. For more information on our debates, talks, and discussions, visit intelligencesquared.com and sign up to the newsletter.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, which obviously the title is based on the mathematical concept of taking a figure and raising it to the power of two to produce a substantially larger result, or a more impressive result. So it's appropriate we have two people here, Stephen D. Levitt, economist from the University of Chicago, and Stephen J. Dubner, journalist from the New York Times, who a few years ago came together in a spectacularly successful symbiotic relationship to rival anything in nature. But which is the crafty clownfish? Which is the poisonous anemone? I'll leave you to judge in the course of the evening. And as we've just been reminded, they together created this Freakonomics phenomenon with their books, Freakonomics, Super Freakonomics, and now Think Like a Freak, which we're going to be concentrating on this evening. But I dare say we can cover all the span of this work. Now, normally when I'm interviewing people on television or radio, I have to assume the proportion of the audience don't really know what we're going to be talking about, so they might not know who the guest is, really, or the subject matter. But I imagine everyone here at the Royal Geographical Society must be here because they're either Freakonomic fans or freaks or determined critics ready with their questions later to put them to the sword. So what we'll do is, after I finish this little preamble, or ramble, I suppose, I'll ask as many questions as I can think of to jog them along and to go over some of the interesting, even controversial topics discussed in this and previous books. And then we'll come to you. The main point of the evening is for you to ask questions. I'll do my best to get questions and take questions from all parts of the room. I think we've got roving microphones and all that jazz. So I'm basically here auditioning to be the Speaker of the House of Commons or a minor member of the Dimbleby family, should one of them ever stop. But that's unlikely. Anyway, so I'm assuming you all know what this is all about, but just in case, I should say that Stephen Levitt is a freak-thinking economist, teaches at the University of Chicago, and Stephen Dubner, oh, I've said this, I'm a writer and journalist. Anyway, they met when Levitt met Dubner met Levitt, when Dubner was interviewing Levitt for a profile in the New York Times. So right from the word go, I'm terrifically impressed that you came together in these circumstances. If only I could develop an empathy to the guests I interview, who knows, I could have become the fourth BG or Jeffrey Archer's co-writer or Cher's next husband. But it wasn't to be in any of those cases. In just to take some of my failures. In their books, they've used economics to analyse subjects and problems out with the normal economic sphere, and also looked at areas of economics in a variety of different ways, sometimes flying in the face of conventional wisdom. This has led them to propound a number of interesting, even startling theories about the rituals of the Ku Klux Klan, the relative value of estate agents and prostitutes, pimps, terrorism and life insurance, the link between legalization of abortion and the reduction in crime, teachers cheating, even match-fixing in sumo wrestling, swimming pools, guns, and there's a hot dog eating contest, which we might come on to first. But their latest book returns to some of those themes, cites new examples, and promises to tell us all how to think smarter about almost everything. So, I may start with the journalist with the questions. Apart from providing a snappy title, what is it that makes you two Freakonomics, Freakonomists or freaks? What's the essence of it?
I will answer that. First of all, you're great, and I think you should just keep going. But since we're supposed to talk, I'd like to just begin with, please say cheese. Okay, thank you very much. So you gave the outlines of our meeting. Let me just go back and we'll start there. So as you said, I am a journalist and I was working on a book about what I thought of as the psychology of money, which is why money is a thing that makes so many people so crazy and irrational. And so I'd been interviewing a lot of people, spending time with a lot of economists, none of whom, by the way, knew anything about money, okay, at all. And my editor at the New York Times asked me if I would go to Chicago to write a profile of this economist named Steve Levitt, who had just won an award. It was called the John Bates Clark Medal, and it's a very esteemed award. And just to show how much less smart I am than the economist, I immediately turned down the assignment because I was neck deep in my book and I wanted to finish that. But then I turned it down another couple times. And finally, I was going to be in Chicago for something else and decided, you know what, let me read his papers and see if maybe it's worth stopping in. So I downloaded and read Levitt's papers, and they were just this cornucopia of fascinating, bizarre stories about cheating sumo wrestlers and whether the first name you give your baby affects that child's outcome. And they had nothing to do with what I thought of as economics. And they were also incredibly clever, not just in their description of the world, but in how they proved their points through data. And so that was very appealing to me. And so I decided to interview him and did. Enjoyed it very much.
Well, let's just break off. So were you looking forward to being interviewed by this smart-ass journalist from New York that was going to write everything down and then report it wrongly, or is that just in Britain?
So pretty much Dubner has come to know that my favorite activity is sitting alone in a room with a computer and data, and I'm pretty antisocial. I don't like people very much. And so the only reason that I was willing to do this interview with Dubner is that I have a rule. And the rule is that I like to make my mom happy. And my mom read the New York Times, and it makes my mom happy when she sees me in the New York Times. So I agreed to do this interview. Now, on the other hand, Dubner came under the pretense he was already going to be in Chicago, and we negotiated that he would stay for 2 hours to interview me. And at the end of those 2 hours, which went pretty well, everything was pretty civil, he said, well, how would you feel if I tagged along for lunch? Now, I didn't really want him to come to lunch with me, but the thing is, when you're being interviewed by a reporter from the New York Times, you have to be nice to them, right? Because they have tremendous power, and as soon as you do something mean, you're sure they're going to embarrass you and write something terrible. So he came to lunch. And that was fine. I said, well, it was really great meeting you. You know, I hope the piece turns out great. And he said, well, actually, I don't have anything to do this afternoon. How would you feel if I came and joined you for the afternoon? And I said, well, that would be fine, except my only plans for this afternoon were to do my favorite thing, which was to go into my office and shut the door and type, you know, with data, play with data for 4 or 5 hours. He said, oh, no problem. I'll just come and watch. Okay. So, but the thing was, Dubner cannot stop talking. Okay. He had read every paper I'd ever written, and he would ask me a question, and I would answer the question. And as soon as I stopped, he would ask me another question. This went all the way through, and then dinner. Okay, we had dinner together. Mm. And then I finally offered to give him a ride back to his hotel, hoping I would be rid of him forever. And he said, you know, how about you pick me up at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning? We start this over.
So you're a freak in the term, you're like a stalker, more than a Yes. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but unless you've never parted since then, there must come a point when you...
Barely. Yeah. So this was started on a Wednesday morning, and by Friday afternoon, so we'd all day Thursday for 12 hours, and Friday morning, I pick him up again at the hotel, and by Friday afternoon, I was so desperate, nearly suicidal, that we ended up at a... It's a little different in the UK, because going to like a betting shop is kind of natural in the UK, but only the lowest of the low in the United States go to off-track betting places. So we are getting drunk in an off-track betting shop in the U.S. when Dubner, after like 33 hours of interrogation, and Dubner says to me, what do you think about the CIA? Which CIA is the organization in the U.S. which is charged with, you know, undercover investigations and catching terrorists.
Yeah, we've heard of the CIA.
Yeah. And I blurted out without thinking, if I had the right data, I would be so much better than the CIA at catching terrorists. Okay, and the moment the words passed my mouth, I thought, oh my God, why did I say that? That was so stupid. But I figured 36 hours of transcripts, what were the chances that that would end up in the article? And I knew Dubner was good when the article was published a few months later, and the last line of the last paragraph was me throwing down the gauntlet to the CIA, saying how I would be better than at catching terrorists.
And yes. Well, that's a general rule of being interviewed by a journalist. The one thing you say, you think, I wish I hadn't said that. That's the thing that's in there. So anyway, so having seized upon that...
Yeah, I seized. But
can we just zoom to the point where either one of you decided this could be a book or this could be more than just a profile?
So I did not hate him as much as he hated me, but I had no... We weren't thinking about doing a book at all, no. So it was my...
You were just thinking of getting rid of you.
That he was thinking about getting rid of me. And when I wrote the article, I loved it, but I was sure that no one would read it because it's an article about an academic economist doing this research about sumo wrestlers and whatnot, and it was coming out in August in the New York Times Magazine. And the only articles they put in the magazine in August are the ones they want to bury, because people are at the beach, they're not going to be reading the magazine. So it's 8 pages about him in August, and I fully expected the article to be a total dud, which is what most things that most writers write turn out to be. There's the period right before a book or an article comes out that we writers call the lull before the lull. It's very very quiet, then the piece comes out and it's still very quiet. And my fear was confirmed when the morning the article came out in the New York Times Magazine, my phone rang once, and it was Levitt's mom back in Minneapolis. She said, I just wanted to thank you for treating my boy fair in the New York Times. And I thought that 3 months I just spent was the stupidest, biggest waste of time possible. But then, as it turns out, we were wrong because people were interested in a book. It took some cajoling because Levitt had no interest in working with me on it, anything at all, right?
So how does it work? Do you come up with all these brilliant analyses or ideas to look at, things to think about, and say, right, you're the journalist, write it up in a way that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mix. I mean, look, I couldn't in a million years write a book that any of you would want to read. And that's what I told the publishers when they first came and said, hey, Dubner has written about you. You should write a book. And I what I said was, well, go to my webpage and read a handful of my academic articles, which get about, I don't know, 100 downloads a year each, and then come back if you really think you want me to write a popular book. And I will say none of the publishers did come back after I told them that. But then somebody came up with the idea that we should write this book together. And I wasn't very excited about it. Dubner wasn't very excited about it. But one thing that we did come to realize is that there was a commonality that we shared, which is that basically for enough money, either of us would do anything. And then it turned out, the publishers were willing to give us enough money. But then the key thing, I mean, really a critical moment in the relationship was deciding how to split the money, right? We had gotten the sum, but we'd never talked about a split. And it was really, everything kind of hung in the balance, because if you've ever been, say, divorced and had to argue about a zero-sum game of how to split up the assets, you know how contentious it can be. And so Dubner called me on the phone a little bit hesitant, and he said, well, I just wanted to talk about the split. I said, okay. And he said, I'm thinking that we should maybe split the money 60-40. And I said, well, I was actually thinking two-thirds, one-third. And he's kind of quiet, and he said, well, I guess we're not going to be able to do the book then, because there's no way I can do this book for just one-third of the pie. And I said, oh, actually, I was thinking two-thirds for you and one-third for me. And he said, oh, I was thinking 60% for you and 40% for me. So we settled on 50-50, and we've actually, there's been a really good set of good tone for the relationship.
All right. Well, look, I think we've covered you coming together. It's a very romantic story. This is It feels more like a rom-com than anything else. So you didn't like each other at first, then you fell in love, and then...
Right.
Anyway, that's fine. So let's come to this latest book, and we can go back to some of those other more serious examples that you've covered before. But writing this book, this one, you're telling us that we can all... We've read your previous books, maybe, and we can now think like a freak. And people can apply these theories, your theory, his theory, in other... So one example you give, and it's on the cover, so it's good one to start with, is somebody you feel thought like a freak in order to win a hot dog eating contest. So explain how that works and how you can think like a freak and win a hot dog eating contest.
You want this one?
Sure.
Do.
Yeah, I'll take it. So let's imagine that you're a broke college student, which is the situation that this fellow named Kobe, a Japanese college student, was in. And his girlfriend signed him up for this televised eating contest on TV. And he was kind of horrified because he's a slight guy and not gluttonous at all. But it was worth $5,000 if he could win. So he decided to enter it, and he strategized a little bit. We won't get into that detail right now. But he ended up winning his first amateur contest and then decided that because he could win as an amateur eater, he should turn pro. That this field of competitive eating was where his future lied.
What do you make as a pro hot dog eater? I mean, obviously you make a lot of pounds, and you get plenty to eat. But is it sponsored?
There are appearance fees. As the best golfers will get an appearance fee, right? Yeah. Or maybe you yourself might. I'm just inferring might gain an appearance fee just for showing up and looking handsome. He could show up to
just
eat.
Just showing up in my case.
Exactly. So he decided that he would train for what is the Super Bowl of competitive eating, which is the Coney Island Nathan's Famous 4th of July hot dog eating contest in New York City, where the existing world record at the time, this had been going on for about 40 years, the existing world record was 25 1/8 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes. So just imagine the volume and what that is. And most of the former champions were these big, hulking guys who would starve themselves for a few days and then take the pile and just glomp, 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 wash it down, swallow, and do it. And so he began to study the past competitors. And he quickly came to the realization that just because they all ate in the same way from each other and in the same way that the same style as you would eat every day, that was not necessarily the best way to eat. So we thought, what if I experiment, try some different things? So first thing he did was very simple. I'll pick up a hot dog. Instead of eating it with two hands, feeding it like this, what if I could break the hot dog in half and then have two hands to feed it, and it will do some of the work that my jaw is doing? So this maneuver would over time come to be known as the Solomon method, after King Solomon in the Bible, who threatened to cut the baby in two pieces, right? So he did the Solomon, then he starts to eat the dog and bun, and he realizes that eating dog and bun together, there's a density conflict, right? One is very dense and salty and slick, and the other is big and airy. So he thought, what if I separate them? And he does this, and now he finds that he can just kind of slurp the hot dog down, and the bun is big and airy, takes up a lot of time and a lot of room. So now he starts to take the bun, soak it in the water, squeeze out the excess water, and pop it in the mouth like a bun ball, okay? And then further, he doesn't need to pause later to drink like the other guys because he will have already delivered the liquid. So he goes on and on and on, all these different methods and strategies, many of which failed, but he was experimenting. He gets to Coney Island, and in his first ever real hot dog eating contest, he goes out, and as I said, the world record was 25 1/8. He doesn't just win his first contest, but he sets a new world record. And he doesn't just barely set the record, he eats 50 hot dogs in buns in 12 minutes. So it was an astonishing, nobody doubles a world record ever. So immediately, there were charges of cheating. They suspected he was doping, for one, that he had been swallowing muscle relaxants. There was a rumor that he was a Japanese government plot to embarrass America on Independence Day, and that surgeons had implanted a second esophagus and stomach, which was not true. But the point we make, the point we make is that what he did was he asked a fundamentally different question than everybody before him had asked, which was all these other big guys were asking, how do I make more room in my stomach? Which seems pretty sensible, if I want to eat a lot of hot dogs. And he asked a fundamentally different question, which was, how do I make a hot dog easier to eat? And by asking a fundamentally different question, he came up with a fundamentally different set of answers, which glorified his name to this day.
So in the hot dog world, he's a bit like, Dick Fosbury, the Fosbury flop, the guy who reinvented high jump.
Very much so.
Didn't have quite some... he won all the Olympics and stuff
this
time.
It transformed the way of doing. Nobody's jumped forward ever since Fosbury.
But what's interesting about the Fosbury flop is that having talked to a pretty good high jumper once, the difference between the old way of doing and his way of doing was like a 3 or 4 or 5% different. It was a tiny bit better, but not radically at all. In fact, there's some people who don't, who actually still go at it the other way. That's, I mean, obviously, in some sense, people cared more about the high jump than they did about eating hot dogs. But,
yes, I think.
But the transformation that he made, I mean, it was, I mean, we use the example of a comparison to Usain Bolt and running the 100-meter dash. And so it would be the equivalent of him running the 100-meter dash in 4.7 seconds.
Yeah.
So basically like a cheetah or a taxi cab or something like
that.
Yeah,
you can't even achieve that with some of the methods they resort to in athletics. And I'm not suggesting
Usain Bolt. It would be the equivalent of a politician being truthful 70% of the time.
All right. So you're saying he was thinking like a freak. You didn't teach him to that. You just seized upon that as that's an example of what you like to see in people's thought processes.
Exactly. I think if we had a Freakonomics Hall of Fame, he would certainly be a charter member because he did what is incredibly simple and obvious. And it's really what the greatest ideas, I think, are the ones that are completely and totally obvious ex post, and yet there are hundreds of thousands of people who just do the same thing over and over and over, never think to do it, and as soon as someone else does it, it's totally obvious, and everyone switches immediately. And that to me is genius. That to me is brilliance, of being able to see what everyone should have seen but didn't. To me, that's a lot, in some ways, more fundamentally a sign of genius than just having a super high IQ and being able to figure out math problems that no one else can figure out.
Let me go to a more serious topic that you mentioned this book and mentioned previous books and as a story that's very much part of the Freakonomics story. The link that you say exists between the legalization of abortion and the big fall off in the in the crime rate so many years later, several years later. Now, you make that link. I think you did that in your very first book.
Yes.
Could you explain, first of all, how you came to that conclusion, and do you think it still stands up?
Sure. So let me just explain what Clive is talking about. So I have put forth the hypothesis with John Donahue back in the late 1990s, and the idea was that... So just as a background, so there was a huge decline in crime in the United States that caught everyone by surprise. So essentially by now it's like a 50 or 60. So crime is essentially half what it used to be in the U.S. And if you look at the usual suspects, like increased prisons or more police or changes in social values or income distribution, none of those sufficiently explain this at all. So the hypothesis that, before I even talk about the hypothesis, let me tell you how I stumbled onto the hypothesis. It was just, you know, dumb luck in some sense, which is this is back in the old days when people used to actually read books and go to libraries. And so I happened to be in a library looking up a statistic in a book which is called The Statistical Abstract of the United States, which is about this thick and has every figure and table that the U.S. government collects. And so I randomly opened the book to some page as I searched for, you know, page 472, which is the page I wanted, and it fell open to the page that listed the number of abortions in the United States. And it just caught my interest. I was kind of curious about abortions. And I mean, I'd never thought about it, but when I saw the table, I looked at it. And what was shocking to me was how big the number was. So very quickly after we legalized abortion in the U.S., there were between 1 million and 1.5 million abortions performed every year. And that was a number that was just shocking to me. I couldn't believe how big that number was. So I asked myself, well, how many babies are actually born in the U.S.? And it turned out the number was about 3 million babies a year. And so I did some simple math, and I said, so you're telling me, this book is, that almost one-third of every pregnancy in the U.S. is ending in abortion, okay? And I knew that before abortion was legalized in 1973, that very few abortions were performed. And I just thought to myself, I'm not exactly sure what this is going to affect, but this has got to affect something, right? This just seems like it's got to be important. And so since I was studying crime and trying to figure out why crime was falling, it took me a week or two where I said, I mean, this is probably crazy, but it is possible that legalized abortion might have affected crime. And the theory is actually incredibly simple. The theory is as follows, that unwanted children are known to be at a tremendous risk, elevated risk for crime. Basically, if your mother doesn't love you, lots of bad things happen in your life, including turning into a criminal. Okay? Legalized abortion was likely to have dramatically reduced the number of unwanted children because it gave women who got pregnant by accident an outlet other than having the child. So unwanted children at risk for crime. There are fewer unwanted children. Therefore, you would expect that 20 years later, when this generation grew up and the unwanted children had been aborted, there wouldn't be as many criminals around. So it's like an incredibly simple theory. It's kind of hard, as jarring and revolting as the theory is, it kind of makes sense, okay? But people hate the idea, but it's the logic is really simple. So then we went to the data, and John Donahue and I, and in the data, I think very clearly using what we call a kind of a collage of data approach, so a bunch of different sources to identify this sort of patterns in the data, it really looks to be important. And by our best estimates, maybe a third to a half of all of this incredible decline in crime that happened in America was triggered by the legalization of abortion. And it was maybe one of the most unpopular hypotheses ever put forth.
It's unpopular because it's startling, but it's also some other academics have subjected a lot of criticism to say it's not necessarily true. They challenge your methodology. And, of course, it's quite a hard thing to prove one way or the other because it could, supposing it was something else causing this. Yeah. Just take a random example that I'm aware of, and I've no idea how true it might be. Some people say not having lead in the petrol has improved our brain development, and that might be because crime is falling in this country as well as America, and, of course, it could in both cases be due to the legalization of abortion, but it might be something else altogether.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so on the lead, so I have to admit, long before the current round of lead crime research, I looked at that as well. Mm. So my view was that that wasn't actually true. That when I looked at the data carefully, it's a discussion for a different time. But I actually think that that's an extremely plausible hypothesis because there's a link between lead exposure and lower IQ. And low IQ is a strong predictor of crime. It just turns out that I'll spend 15 seconds trying to debunk this other theory, which is it's kind of interesting. But lead is so heavy, it turns out that and really lead only comes from gasoline. That there is lead in paint, but it's not really important. But lead comes from gasoline. But the lead in the gasoline is so heavy that it gets put up in the air, but it's so heavy that it can only float like 50 or 100 yards. So basically, if you grew up meters, 1500, use meters, right? Basically, if you grew up in the 1960s or 70s next to a freeway, you probably turned into a criminal. Because it is true that the lead density around freeways would have knocked probably 10 or 20 points off of your IQ by virtue of it. Okay, but in general, for 99.5% of the population, it probably didn't have any effect whatsoever. And when you look at the data, you can't find it. Yeah. But so there certainly have, believe me, there have been so many critics. I believe that we've given out our data on abortion and crime to maybe 500 different researchers who want to test it. And it's really embarrassing to say, but we did in table 10 of our paper, the academic paper, we made a mistake. And I'm so regretful of that mistake because although it wasn't really important to the results, it's kind of like, I don't know if people are following this debate on Piketty's Capital. Now there's like FT is saying that he made a mistake. And like when you make a mistake, even in one very small part, then everyone for the rest of time assumes that you made a mistake and everything was totally wrong. But I would say, I mean, look, I'm not a very credible source on this topic, but I'm going to say that I think my stuff has stood the test of time. But I do really think, actually, that the evidence we've seen has been pretty supportive. And let me say one last thing, which is maybe a little too geeky that this audience doesn't care about. But it actually turns out that there's something very specific about the abortion problem, which makes it easier to know whether our thesis is true than you otherwise would be the case. And that is that, you know, we have a very peculiar thesis, which is that something happens in the world, okay, and then it's not for another 18 or 20 years that that thing has any real impact on society. And so what we have, what we have in the U.S. is that after abortion was legalized, some states, abortion became very easy to get. In other states, although de jure, although the law said you could get an abortion, nobody provided abortions. So in the state of North Dakota, there was exactly one legal abortion provided in the first couple years. Okay, so you have a set of states where it's legal everywhere, but in some states there are lots of abortions.
So other
states
are sort of control groups to work.
And so what you see is for the next 18 years, the crime patterns in these two sets of states exactly mirror each other. Yeah. And then roughly 18 years later, they start slowly breaking apart until by the full effect of abortion, legalized abortion, as kids get older and older and older, there's a 35% difference in crime. And it's very hard to come up with another theory, although there are other hypotheses you can make, that exactly triggers that pattern in the data. And
Well, you can see it's an uncomfortable theory to play with and to think about. It takes you in almost to the area of eugenics, doesn't it, of sorting out the population in a way to make society better by knocking out undesirables, not at birth, but before birth.
Sound like a real fan.
If I recall correctly, Levitt, tell me if I don't, but that a lot of the abortions performed were with women who were not choosing to not have children at all, but changing the timing. Yeah. And I think that was really an element of it, which is that it's not about the people being bad people, it's about the people being born into a situation that wasn't ready yet, which I think changes the way that you will look at what it means to raise a child, and have productive people in society.
Can I say, is it completely related to this very much into the new book?
I seem to remember you said that he never stops talking, but that's... So
I think this is really perfect for one of the points we make in the new book, which is this is an issue, the abortion crime, which is so laden with moral and ethical issues that most people, and even more so in America, I mean, people in America are tied in knots when it comes to legalized abortion. And what's interesting is one of the things we say when you're trying to tackle your own problems is however emotional or however moral you think your stance is on a problem, our advice is to start by just putting the morality and the ethical part, put it in the background and try to think about a problem in as clear-headed and simple, data-driven way as possible. Okay, and that helps you to understand the patterns in the world. So basically, I mean, the thing I just said about abortion is completely and totally obvious, right? I mean, unwantedness, it's like the simplest chain of logic imaginable. And yet no one had managed to come up with it in the 30 years, 25 years since abortion had been legalized. And I think that's because as soon as people started to think about abortion, they went off into the moral space and the ethical space. And by doing that, you can get a sense of the world. Now, we're not saying throw the morality out forever. We're saying figure out how the world works, figure out what problem you want to solve, and what steps you can take and what the results would be, and then go back and layer your morality and your ethical views on to deciding what path to take. Okay. I think it's really important.
Now, I just want to cover another topic, get you to deal with it, another serious topic, which is climate change, global warming. You discussed this at some length in your book. Now, you endorse, as it were, or discuss a possible solution to global warming, which is a particularly freaky one. Have I said enough about that to nudge you into telling us what that is?
Or? You have indeed. So you're picking all the fun topics tonight, I see, abortion and climate change. So let me frame what we were trying to accomplish. This was in our second book, Super Freakonomics, where we basically looked at the situation of climate change and posed it a different kind of question, kind of like Kobe, around the issue, and said, if climate change is indeed a grave danger, then what should you do about it? Okay, so the if is, for now, unanswerable. There's a lot of uncertainty. But let's assume that it will be a grave danger. What do you do about it? And we were making the argument that one thing that appears pretty certain, partly because of the science and partly because of the half-life of carbon dioxide and because of the way the greenhouse effect works, but especially because of human behavior, that the one big proposal that's been on the table for many years to address climate change probably won't work. That was our kind of starting argument.
And our use of carbon.
Yeah, what we meant by that.
You can't persuade us to do that.
Exactly. That while in a perfect world, if we could eliminate all carbon and that would begin to reverse the greenhouse effect and that would return our climate to exactly where we want it, if that were all true, which it could be, the fact is that you need to get about 7 billion people to kind of voluntarily or by price agree to do something that is opposite what they want to be doing. Yeah. So we said, since that's going to be so very difficult, what if we could talk about alternative options if indeed climate change becomes exceedingly dangerous. Yeah. And then we brought up a kind of suite of ideas, suite with an SU, that are all under the umbrella of what's called geoengineering, the very name of which makes people recoil a lot like some people recoil the minute you bring abortion into a topic. And so these involve manipulating, in some ways very gentle and in some ways not as gentle, the climate to produce a temperature under which we can all live. The irony is that many people who recoil at the idea of intentionally manipulating the environment in any way fail to acknowledge that the reason that we think we are where we are is because we have intentionally manipulated the environment in a grave way.
But you sort of touch on the fact that, you know, having lots of windmills, you know, might not work particularly well.
It might one day, but not scalable
solar
now.
Panels, don't
right.
But so I want to just force you onto what's the solution that you, as it were, endorse or thinks worth investigating?
Right. So there were two major solutions, one of which is less crazy than the other. You want the more crazy one first or the less crazy one first?
That's less of a crazy one I was aiming for, but
you want the crazy
one?
Well,
to illustrate the freakishness of your economics.
So do you all know, Munch painted many versions of The Scream, which I'm sure you've all seen at least a few of, right? And he's screaming, and you remember what color the sky is behind? Remember, it's a very fiery, bloody red. And that's because, apparently, this was a year after, the year of, I believe it was Krakatoa, right? So when a volcano, a big supervolcano, blows, it spews a great deal of sulfur dioxide and other stuff into the sky. And into the stratosphere, actually. And what that does, the long-term effect, is for a period of up to a year and a half, it actually refracts enough sunlight so that there will be global cooling to the order of 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit. So if that is desirable, not saying it is, but if it is, so let's say that the Earth begins to get habitually much too warm, what would happen if some mad scientists, who we happen to know a few of, and we wrote about, could replicate that big volcano, except rather than depending on a volcano to blow up at just the right time in just the right place, what if they could replicate that with science by, let's imagine, stringing up a fire hose to the stratosphere and outfitting it with very lovely high-tech nozzles that would spray a fine mist of sulfur dioxide, or maybe it's even water, because there are a lot of chemicals that can produce the greenhouse effect and refract some sunlight.
How big is this hose pipe? How tall is this going to be? Are we talking 100 yards, a mile?
No. Several kilometers. I forget
several
the number
kilometers.
Now.
So,
a few miles up in the sky.
So it's quite a long hose pipe.
It's a long hose pipe.
But it's not
because I have literally rolling mine in the garden and taking it out again.
And
how's it going to be held up?
Balloons, weight-bearing balloons. And it would be pumped by these kind of pumps that are in a swimming pool. Now, the key thing is, let's just pretend for a minute this were viable, which the scientists believe it is, but let's pretend it's viable scientifically. Politically, it immediately becomes, okay, how many hoses are there? And is it Putin with his hand on the thermometer? Or is it Obama? Or was it Hugo Chavez at one point? You know, these are the kind of people. So depending on the price of oil, heating oil, and the price of a lot of other things, you might have great disputes. So the governance is an entirely different discussion. The morality is a different one, but it is the concept of thinking different or freakishly, which is if the proposed solution on the table, while morally delicious, like let's not use carbon, is practically impossible, might there be alternative solutions to consider? Yeah. That's the idea.
So when you stray into these other areas of discussion, do you ever worry that you're getting into areas that you don't know enough about to be able to deal with as an economist?
So we never, ever try to pretend we know stuff we don't know, and we know nothing about climate science. And none of the arguments we made were really predicated on understanding very much about climate science. What we really did, to put it in kind of Kobe terms, what Kobe the Eater said is, you know, instead of, like Dubner said, instead of trying to make my stomach big, I'm kind of eat each hot dog fast. And it turned out that wasn't the case. We just kind of took the issue of global warming, and we said the issue isn't, you know, how to have less carbon, which is right. Basically everyone frames it. How do we reduce greenhouse gases? We just took a really simple view of the world, which is if the Earth's too hot, what's the cheapest, fastest way to cool it down? Okay, which is a question which isn't really about, you know. So then we go to the scientists and look at the published record on it. So what we added there, I think, was really a different worldview. And again, it was so critical to step back from the morality, because the arguments about climate change are so laden with morality, how we have ruined the Earth for the future, which is, you know, probably true. Okay, that's fine. But it doesn't help you necessarily to have a lot of guilt about it. If the real, I mean, so here's my view.
You've still got to find a solution.
That's you find the solution, and maybe you don't even, maybe we're not ready yet, as citizens of the globe, to actually start shooting sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. Okay, but I kind of think of it this way: to carry out a small scale experiment where we put sulfur dioxide in small quantities up there and we measure what happens, in order to know how reactive it is and how effective it is, would pose no risk to humankind or the planet. Okay, it would cost almost nothing. It would cost, you know, this whole plan per year would cost, I don't know, I think $200 million, as opposed to the price tag on carbon, you know, which is like, you know, $1 trillion or something every year. And basically, why not figure out whether we have options for, say, when the Greenland ice shelf starts to just float away into the oceans and we have complete world catastrophe on our hands, why wait until that moment to progress science? But that's exactly the attitude that has happened. And the scientists who have published these articles have been completely unable to be funded by any government. Government terrified of doing this. In fact, one of the few people who've been willing to fund this stuff at all, but he did it really quite secretly, was Bill Gates, because Bill Gates thought the science made sense, but he didn't want any attention for funding these geoengineering experiments because he was afraid people wouldn't like him.
I suppose you start doing that, you're then in control of the climate in a very direct way. You're turning it on and off, and people have different views about how hot or cold they want it to be.
I mean, it's completely amazing that anybody with $100 million can choose the temperature of the Earth right now. Okay? I mean, that's just a fact of life. And there's really no internet. So another way we didn't talk about, which I don't think there's any international law that could stop someone from doing, is that if you, 10,000 dinghies? You need 10. So basically, if you put 10,000 little solar-powered dinghies out into the ocean, and behind them, you had them spray up sea salt, okay, that the sea salt will rise up and will form clouds. And clouds are more reflective than water. The ocean's very dark, so it absorbs the heat. You actually, with 10,000 dinghies, it's estimated, could reduce return the temperature of Earth to pre-industrial levels. Oh. And I don't know how you can't stop a crazy guy or a smart guy or a guy who likes to have fun from putting 10,000 dinghies out in the ocean and puttering around.
We've got to coordinate this, because if there's one guy with these 10,000 dinghies, another one with these hose
exactly.
pipes in the air,
it's
going to be. I'm going to go to questions from the audience. Just one thing I wanted to not exactly pick you up on, but just make a point in passing is you make the point that something like vaccination is not obvious when somebody first comes up with it. We're going to take a little bit of germ and put it in you. And then in a nearby page, you say, of course, George Bernard Shaw was a great thinker and came up with hundreds and hundreds of ideas, as he himself claimed. But oddly enough, and I just wanted to make this point, he was a virulent opponent of vaccination throughout his very long life. And had he been listened to on that point as a sort of a somewhat unconventional thinker, we wouldn't have eliminated smallpox from the world.
But, yeah. So, I mean, that's a great example of another thing we talk about. What's the word? I never remember that word.
It's too long. Ultra-crepidarianism.
Ultra-crepidarianism. So it's
ultra-crepidarianism.
Whatever the word is. You can look it up. It's in the book. But one of the things that you see so much is that when somebody is good at something, they then assume, and often society assumes, that they're going to be good at everything else too. And I think it's a classic example of this halo effect, which happens, in which in which expertise or genius is thought to be very transportable. And I think, well, Clive, that's what you accused us of about 5 minutes ago.
Well,
and we tried to deny it was true. Yeah. So we tried to say, no, we're actually just using the same stuff over and over.
Well,
but
it's a reasonable point, though. If you're an expert, as you are, on economics, then you're not necessarily going to understand all the ramifications of pumping sulfur dioxide into the air or a crime, necessarily.
Right.
Whatever.
No, I think you're right. So I think the key fact is that I'm not even an expert in economics, right? So much less climate science. What I think the only thing that I'm good at, really, are two things maybe, which is taking a pile of data and making sense of it and being unrestrained enough to offer really dumb ideas out in public and not be embarrassed about the fact that people are going to laugh at me. I mean, those are my traits, and there's a common theme that runs through everything we do.
Okay. Right, well, there's lots of other subjects covered in your books, but as I've promised more than once now, excellent. I can see a hand go up immediately, so Well, we'll see how this works. So you're an experiment. Let's hope this works really well. A microphone gets you. You ask a nice, clear question. And
hi, guys. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, so for turning up. I just wanted to ask about kind of tools for thinking like a freak, because it seems to me the success of your books and podcasts, et cetera, is that it kind of brings a, you know, we're in this age of big data now, and we're all trying to understand how Google controls our lives and how we can control it as well. So my question is, other than your own book, what would you recommend as tools for people to use to learn to, you know, think like a freak? Because so often the people who who think magically are confident and arrogant, and the people who want to ask questions differently are humble. So
all right.
So what other tools are out there to... Good question.
Great.
Really good. Maybe your books, I don't know.
Your tools is what he wants to know about, first of all.
Well, our tools are easy because we wrote the book. Yeah. I mean, look, okay, so what our very first tool in the book is learn to say, I don't know, because so much of what we've been talking about today is, right, the flip side of ultra-crepidarianism or whatever it is acknowledging when you look at a difficult situation or problem that you may not know at all what the solution is. Yes. And in politics, we see, you know, we actually went through the presidential debate records of 40 or 50 years and found that no candidate ever appeared to be willing, at least, to admit that he didn't really know how something would turn out. We're deathly afraid of it. In the U.S., yeah. Right. And on the media, you know, if you're the kind of person who would get on TV or radio and someone would ask you a very difficult question, and even a very difficult question, you would say, you know, I wish I knew the answer to that, but it's hard to say because of X, Y, Z. We'll try to find out. So we encourage people to take that as the first step, to admit what they don't know.
But could you, just to interrupt, could a politician do that, not America,
so, you know,
or any other country?
I think that is a great question. We argue that it would be a wonderful world if that were so.
Yes.
Honestly, I think the way the game is constructed, they would probably lose. And that's not really their fault. That's the way the incentives are set up. Yeah. In terms of other tools beyond what we do, I love the question. I don't know the answer to your question, though. So practicing that. But I don't mean
to make
light of it.
He wants you to recommend other people's works.
Yeah. So
they're going to buy your book as well.
We have this unbelievably voluminous endnote section to all our books that I do for fun and just to have all the sources there. And no one has ever read an endnotes. We've sold 7 million books, and I've never heard from anyone who actually commented on something that was in the endnotes. Mm. If you care to be the first person to ever read the endnotes in any of our books, you will find a library worth of where we steal our ideas from. So,
yeah.
I kind of agree, but I have two suggestions of books that I really like because they've changed. These are people who've changed what I think. And the first one is Nudge by Daler and Sunstein. And this has actually had a huge impact in the UK because of the Behavioral Insights team, which is an incredibly forward-looking team. We can talk more about it later if you want, within the UK government. And the idea behind Nudge, essentially, is typically economists have viewed the world, which is through the lens of incentives. That if I can give you the right incentives through prices or something else, I can get you to change your behavior by responding. And Nudge is something which is more brought from psychology, which says people are busy, people are distracted, so if we just trick them, we can get them to do whatever we want. It's just a matter of taking advantage of their lack of attention. And so it's a great book with lots of examples, and it's an incredible toolkit to have if you want to change people's behavior. And the other book, which has been phenomenally successful in the UK, is Thinking Fast and Slow by Danny Kahneman. Kahneman is the godfather of behavioral economics, which is the intersection of economics and psychology. And it's a tough read. I mean, so unlike Nudge, which is fun, I think the Kahneman book has been far more purchased than read. But look, you'll impress people just by having it in your shelf, even if you can't get through more than a few pages. But it's a pretty good book. But
you also mentioned your book sometimes, Malcolm Gladwell, with The Tipping Point and those sort of books, who does have a similar-ish kind of approach to some of the issues.
Yeah, I love Malcolm Gladwell's books. I think they're great storytelling, but I think they fall into a different category because I really think those are storytelling books. I think they're not really ways of thinking. They're about entertaining and making. Basically, when you read Malcolm Gladwell's books, for the 6 hours it takes you to read it, you feel like you are the smartest person on the planet, and that is an incredible gift to give to someone. Yeah. But I.
And when we're reading your books, we're supposed to think you too are the smartest.
No, you're supposed to feel like you're also. Malcolm's really good, so when you read our books, you feel like the third or fourth smartest person on the planet. When you read Malcolm's, you really feel like the smartest. But
okay, all right, good question. No longer than that, though. That was, an expansive question. Any more questions? There's one right down here. Two down here.
Hello. I'm just wondering if there are any trends that you're seeing today that where you think that there'll be a huge impact in the future. So, for example, one-child policy in China, or flu vaccines for everybody, or kids age 3 learning on the iPad, or something that'll have a massive impact 20 years down the line.
So a bit like the abortion thing, which you
for an example, yeah,
identified.
Seeing out in the future.
Did you ever look at the one-child policy in China, to take that specific example?
So I've thought about that a bit, and I don't know too much about China, but it is an incredibly radical social experiment. And it's changed so many things, and the attention that's given to individual children, and it's had a huge impact, of course, on the sex ratio, because right now, I don't know if there are maybe 120 boys born for every 100 girls, which, already you can see the waves of men. Many men will never get married. Already the age gap between men and women has grown dramatically. I think ultimately there will be some repercussions. I think it'll be interesting. So one prediction I would have, this is not maybe an important, but one prediction I think that an economist would say is that eventually the poorest of the poor in China will start having girls instead of boys. Because if you're very poor in China and you have a boy, that boy will never be married. And so instead, I think that, it will flip and there will actually become a real desire for girls.
Or it could put the crime rate up again.
Absolutely.
In those countries, because unattached men without the, mellowing influence of a wife or a girlfriend, that's a recipe for crime as much as anything else.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I would not laugh at that. I think that's completely true. I think even deeper, I think if you look, you could predict revolution, right? There's nothing worse for a set of rulers than having 300 million men, young men with nothing to do, mulling around trying to figure out what they should do next. I think you're exactly right.
We should say China, obviously one-child policy legislated and changed behavior. But throughout Asia, there are a lot of countries where son preference is so strong that the ratio is about the same as it is in China. And so, throughout much parts, but the most bizarre, perhaps, and interesting is that a lot of immigrant Asians to the U.S. have the same son preference as is exhibited in Asia. So through selective abortion and other manipulations, you see a preference is so strong. So I think, in a way, the even bigger question than what becomes of the policy as it's acted out is, does the preference for sons change as labor markets and militaries and so on change?
Mm. It was a fantastic question, and I think your ideas you embedded in it were really good. Because I myself, although I have no answers at all, I'm really curious to understand, as this generation of children that has grown up with screens 100% of the time, so my own children cannot entertain themselves for 15 seconds without an electronic equipment in front of them. And it's one of those things where I don't think anyone knows, but one could imagine that there are all sorts of ramifications related to, say, delaying gratification. So delaying gratification is an absolutely fundamental skill to adulthood, in the sense that many of the things we do, like education, you pay the cost and you make an investment now because of some future return. And so one could imagine, perhaps, that the ability to delay gratification will be negatively impacted by the availability of 200 TV channels and screens and all the time, which could, but I don't know anyone. I'm sure people are researching it. I have not, but that is a question that to me is really fascinating.
We're getting a bit into a sort of worry zone with some of these questions, so just to sort of cheer it up a bit, there could also be the fact that people can link up with so much knowledge so quickly and so much information and data, which is your particular joy, This is from you know, it's only 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It was, you know, you had to walk to a library. Now, you're in the middle of the night, you can get stuff in seconds.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so no one could be a bigger fan of technology than I am. And amazing. We are the most fortunate. I mean, if you take all of the people who have ever walked the planet, those of you in this room are among the top, you know, 1/1000th of 1% of the most privileged, lucky people who've ever lived. And it's because of the incredible progress we've made in technology in terms of producing food and goods and entertainment and things like that. So I'm 100%, I agree with you 100% with respect to that. And I'll give you one example. So when I was in graduate school getting a PhD, if you wanted to do an analysis on the U.S. Census, it took a research assistant an entire summer to take this big, heavy magnetic tape, spin it, download it. It was incredibly manual labor intensive. Now it takes you 10 seconds to go onto the web and do it. And it's funny because obviously that's great progress for mankind in terms of being able to have access to information. But I'll tell you, the professor who I did that for when I was a graduate student was really upset. He said, "This is the worst thing ever. It used to take a whole summer for a research assistant to do that. And I was the only one who had enough money to hire the research assistants to do it. Now everyone can do it. It's terrible. Yeah. I don't have an advantage anymore in doing my research." Well,
things move on. All right. So I haven't had a question from the balcony. Is anybody up there want to raise their hand? You're being a bit shy. These American authors expect... Oh, yes, sir. I'll stop berating you. So over there... Oh, you've got to come... I'm sorry. You've got to walk... of course, you're in the cheap seats. How about just shouting? See if we can do it like that. Up there, see, down here, we bring the microphone to you.
Don't shout.
No, I've been told not to do that. God, everything I... Up there, they're in the steerage class. They have to walk to the microphone. It's like flying economy up there. I don't know if there's a price differential or just you arrive here late. Oh, God, this question better be good now. I've had all this walking.
I'd like to ask Stephen Levitt what his daily routine is. How does he get up and think, well, look at it. Whole lot of different data today, or how does he spot data and work on it?
All right, this is like a nightmare going back to when you originally met, being asked these dreadful questions. What is your daily routine? What do you do? How do you think? Where do you come up with your ideas?
Yeah, so I mean, I wish I had an interesting answer to that question. You know, I used to, when I was younger, I had the luxury of having very few demands on my time. So the U.S. academic system is so totally broken that my requirements in the classroom are about 60 hours a year, okay? And before I started, you know, writing books and coming talking to nice groups like you, I had lots of time to just think. And I would say I spent about an hour a day for many, many years thinking in one form or another, whether it's just sitting on the couch staring into space or, going to the library and leafing through journals from other disciplines to try and see what interesting questions I had that economics might be able to apply to. Now I would say my life is kind of like everyone else's in that I'm pulled in 100 different directions and people want me to go to meetings and I got to play a lot of golf because I love golf. And so I don't know. I mean,
you mentioned golf in one or all of your books. I don't know, but certainly one of them. You had an ambition to become a professional golfer when you were young. How close did you get to that, do you think?
So luckily for me, although I dreamed of being a professional golfer, I wasn't very good. Because the worst possible life you can almost imagine is to be good enough to think you'll be a professional golfer, but instead to spend your entire life pursuing that dream, making about 10,000 pounds per year, struggling along, and then realizing when you're 45 years old that you have absolutely zero skills and you somehow have to make it the next 40 years of your life. So it turned out I wasn't very good, but look, I always have...
Better to be a ninth-rate golfer than
golfer. Yeah. But I also have a view that if you possibly can, you should turn your hobbies into money-making activities because they become much more justifiable if you can make money. And so I wasn't good enough to make money playing golf, but Dubner and I have now actually convinced the publishers to let us write The Freakonomics of Golf as our next book. And we've hooked up with local boy Luke Donald, a Brit and a friend, who together we're going to write the greatest golf book ever, which is going to show you how, by thinking like a freak, to cut at least 4 strokes off of your game per round, and by practicing smart, the way Luke does, maybe another 2 or 3 strokes.
And the happy news for you, but the slightly depressing is that'll sell more books to golfers who think they can make themselves be great golfers by reading a book than dealing with the problems of the world, global warming, crime, everything.
We have gotten more emails from our occasional mention of our book on golf than on just about any topic we've ever studied.
Okay. So any more? Yes, sir. Right. I'll come to you further back in a moment. So we'll start here, and because his hand happened to catch. We'll come to you next.
Not a question about golf, but about data. And you mentioned we have more access to more information than we've ever had before. Sometimes it seems we, in democracies, know are less informed than we've ever been before about crime rates or immigration or things like that. And sometimes even when we are informed about, say, gun control, rates of gun crime, we still make apparently irrational decisions. Do you think we're getting more irrational, less irrational, and what can you do to help us?
Okay.
Me or you?
Well, I think it's a data question. Don't feel left out.
I'll take the question.
I think the essence of that question, which is that we've got more and more data, it's more easily available. Maybe there's too much, and only people like you can understand it, and it just all washes over us. I don't know if I'm recasting your question too much.
No, I think certainly there's more data. It's more available. I think what has become apparent, however, as data has become more available, is the fact that public policy, political decisions, are rarely determined by looking at the data. And that, so I've been an academic for 20-something years. I've written many papers that have policy relevance. Not once, ever, am I aware of changing a politician's mind on any issue ever. So my research has been used, but only by politicians who happen to have already made up their mind and look to find that my research supported what they already believed. And I think that's the final thing, is that economists have virtually no power in the world. That in terms of politics, certainly I know the U.S. better, that no decision is ever made really based on what the economists think. It's always the policy people who decide it. And they have a very different set of incentives.
Can I give you a local example? Yeah. Today, there have been two bits of stuff put out. In relation to there's a referendum going to take place whether Scotland should become independent from the United Kingdom. And one side of it is saying, I think the figures are roughly this, that it would be £5 billion better for Scotland to be independent. And the other side say it's roughly £5 billion better to stay within the United Kingdom. They're using, obviously, different bits of data, but it's from the grand pool of things they're drawing from that. Now, maybe you could provide a service when these sort of debates flare up, to say, well, look, I'm going to analyse this figure for you, because that's such a big swing as to which way. It's not like, although it may cost a bit, but it's worth it. It's pulling in the opposite direction.
I mean, given that the swing is worth $10 billion to the Scots, for $1 billion, I'd be happy to try and answer that question.
Is this something that's not really the academic's fault or even the general public's fault, but media's fault. We like to blame the media.
That's how I would answer, is that when you look at the people who provide the data that support X argument, $5 X, or Y argument, $5 billion negative, you can't blame the people who supply a very limited shard of data because they're advocates. That's what they are. And politicians largely are advocates. The problem is that the media, of which I am a relatively proud member, is neither trained nor incentivized to do that kind of work. And and those are two separate parts. The training is you need to learn how to understand what you're looking at. You know, every day, if you're a TV producer or a print reporter, you'll get surveys coming across your desk that make an argument whose numbers look foolproof. But we're not trained to tear them apart and understand how reliable or polluted the data are. So I'll give a for instance. Let's say I want to ask you, show of hands, raise your hand if after you use a public toilet, you do not wash your hands, okay? Go ahead, hoist them high. Let's see what we have here. Right. So we see a hygiene rate of, 99.5%. So, as a matter of fact, I know that, I mean, you look to be a fairly hygienic group of people, but I know that probably about 30% of the men, at least, are lying to me, okay? And we know, because there's actual data on this very question, and I gather some of, you know, I'm not a Levitt, but even I can gather this data. I do this in airport restrooms. I carry a notebook, and after, if I need to use one, I'll linger at the sink and just mark down. And as it turns out, about 70% of the men who use a toilet after getting off a plane will wash their hands. The point is, if you bring the 30% of the non-washers in here and sit them among their friends, family, and so on, they're not going to declare their actual behavior either. So depending, if I'm the Centers for Disease Control and I see the data that you just told me, that you have 99.5% hand hygiene compliance, and I'm a journalist, I might very well run that article. The other part is that journalism, as much as we hate to admit it, is really market-driven. And journalism, every newspaper and every radio and TV outlet appeals to its audience. And we write in the new book a good bit about how the smarter a person is, the more likely they are to consume more information that supports their underlying biases, rather than seek out information that might challenge what they know. So you see a bunch of brilliant people who consume media that will confirm what they already know. They become more confident that what they already know is right and have ad nauseum arguments with each other across the aisle, which produce absolutely nothing.
All right, there was a question there. I think it was a female hand. I'm just, so this microphone should go
there. Is it attached to a female?
Well, I haven't got the data on that yet, but I'm prepared to do some in-depth research later. So let's...
yeah. I am female.
Sorry.
The question is, how did you know... I hope I get the names right. Stephen Dubner.
Yes.
That it would be worthwhile staying 36 hours.
Oh.
How did you make a smart decision without data?
All right, that's a great question, but I would attribute it mostly to luck and to insecurity. So... I had an unusual upbringing compared to my peers in high-level journalism in New York, which is that most of my peers were extremely well-educated in families that trained them well to inhabit the upper tiers of society. And I came from a wonderful and loving family that was the opposite of that in every way. So my parents were intelligent, but I grew up the youngest of eight on a farm in the middle of upstate New York. And I mean, one reason I talk so much now is because I never had the chance when I was younger as the youngest of eight. And I'm making up for lost time. But so I had kind of middling schooling until I moved to New York. I was in a rock band and we succeeded. We got a record contract and moved to New York, at which point I decided to quit that career because I didn't want to be a rock star, as it turned out, after all. And then I went to graduate school at Columbia, which was very fortunate. And there, for the first time, I began to experience the kind of education that I would have liked all along. So I worked really hard, but by the time I got into journalism at the New York Times, I still felt constantly, and still do, and I treasure it, feel constantly inferior to many people who have had many more years of experience and the kind of training that I envy. And so I simply do what many, many, many people in my position do, which is compensate by overworking. And in that case, he was the victim, but it could have been anyone. So
so had you done this before with somebody else that's interviewed for an hour and you stay for a week?
I was famous among my colleagues in journalism and among the people I interviewed for just being a ridiculously, obnoxiously long attention span. So, you know, I've written about Steven Spielberg, and, you know, these are people who are used to giving a 45-minute... So I once got... I got Spielberg to spend more time with me than you. I spent a week with Spielberg, and I talked my way onto his private plane when he was coming back from California. I got a free ride home from Steven Spielberg. And I think just the key, really, to doing that, if any of you are writers or care to be writers, is just, you know, have a sincere appreciation for the person you're talking to and what they do. So like Levitt, the one thing I did that was smart was I really did read all his stuff so that it wasn't just idle chat or, like, tell me about what you do, because that's not a question that elicits anything worthwhile. But you'll find that most people are narcissistic. I mean, we all are. And if you ask them to explain why they're so amazing, they're pretty happy to talk for a long time.
Okay. There's a question there. The hand went up very quickly. Yes, excellent. I saw a hand up there, so I've got one Thanks. To go to after that, please.
So my question is, it's not, and it's probably for both of you, because I think you'll both have a different take on it, which is, I'm not going to say it's easy to look at past Freak, but it's certainly easier. You can do sort of regression and correlation analysis and things like that and come up with a clever outcome. What I'm curious about is, in your current research, are there any characteristics of a future Freak idea that either of you think are absolutely essential for you to claim that as something with tremendous provenance?
Characteristics of an idea that we wish to claim? Is that what you said? Please rephrase your question.
Are there any...
No, I'm sorry. I had bad schooling, like I told you. I'm sure others would have.
Future Freak.
Are there any sort of certain character traits of a future Freak idea that give you certainty that this is something worth thinking about or indeed worth investigating further?
Was that sort of new ideas on the boil? Things you're going to be attempting to predict the future with? I know you counsel against trying to predict too much the future.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give a quick answer to that, which is that predicting the future is so difficult, and it's so much easier to take the past and dissect the past. And so I'm never certain. You talked about being certain. Never certain at all that anything we do will be very good predictive. But I mean, in essence, what I think you're saying is, how do we choose what to, how do we choose what to start working on? And in that regard, I'd say that there's a sort of mix of interest of what actually interests us. And I think we put a real premium on doing things that are fun and things that catch our attention, whether or not we think other people will like it. And often data intensive is good. So if I'm looking for a problem, I want something that's fun, data intensive. It's great if it's important, too, and that people will care about it. It's really, of all the things so that get me started on a project, I wander around doing nothing more sophisticated than when people say something to me, almost always the first thing I do is I say, does that make any sense? In my head, I say, does what I just was told make any sense? And a lot of times, maybe, one out of 10 times when someone spouts some kind of conventional wisdom, my internal kind of alarm bell goes off and I say, that doesn't really make any sense to me. And I really like to study those kind of questions where I think, the things that our mother told us are convenient and sound good but aren't really true. And I'd say maybe one time out of 10, the data might support my conjecture that things didn't make sense. So one out of 100 times that someone says something to me, maybe in the end it leads to something that's interesting. And that's kind of my formula for trying to come up with what's...
I want to move us on. I want to try and get another couple of questions in. There was one up there, one down there. So start up in the balcony, please.
When I was getting ready for work this morning, I heard little bits on Radio 4. And one was, how can England win on penalties if you think like a Freak? Please tell us.
All right.
If you win more...
You cover penalty kicks in your book.
Are you asking how can England make more PKs or how can England actually win a match? Because that's a fundamentally different argument. So, first of all,
I don't like the analogy of PKs, by the way. It's a penalty kick.
Okay, excuse me.
We're English. Yeah. It's football, not soccer.
Yeah. Okay, you asked your question. I think you've made your point. I think the underlying flavour of that question is you have assumed that you can tell us how to take penalty kicks and you're an American. But we have a statistical approach to this.
So, just to be clear,
this paper was written with someone from Monaco. Okay, so it's not a purely American take.
French data.
So, first of all, let me just offer.
You're really playing to the crowd now.
There's another piece of French data. Do you remember that? That will make them even angrier. We did in the illustrated edition of Super Freakonomics, we did what we call lovingly the penis flag chart. You remember that? Where we compared penis sizes around the world represented by vertical flags. And I'm afraid your Gallic neighbor was number one. So.
Hang on, I just want to get my head around this, as it were. A flag is on a flagpole, and it flutters upwards like that. Which bit of the flag is up to indicate?
Well, it was all
penis.
Pole, no
all
flag.
Pole.
The,
right.
the pole was the flag.
Okay.
And leading the race of measured peni,
yes,
was France. So let's put that aside.
Where are you getting this data from? Is this from you hanging around the the gents room in the airport?
Back to football.
Yeah.
So let me just offer first my condolences to your country on the following grounds. First of all, I love your country very much, in part because you gave us unwittingly our independence from you. But then, but I love that you've given the world so much. I mean, we had a little bit in the first page of the new book about the Industrial Revolution, among many, many other things. So I love that you've invented all these fantastic games, soccer, cricket, tennis, and so on, but then you give them to the world, and then they beat the crap out of you, and now you're resentful.
Well, you take the opposite approach, which is a much cleverer one, which you invent a game like American football.
And
nobody else wants
it.
To play. So you always win the World Series.
We do indeed.
is that football?
Your penalty kicks, what you want to do, what it boils down to is this. Most kickers go left or right for an upper 90 corner because that's the optimal, unstoppable shot if you can put it there. There's some risk because if you go too far, you can actually miss the goal completely.
Oh, we know that.
Yes, you do. but as it turns out, if you look at the success rate of going left, which is strong side for most right-footed kickers, or right for most left-footed kickers, and then you look at where goalkeepers tend to jump to the kicker's strong side about just under 60% of the time. And to the kicker's weak side, to their left, about 40% of the time, which means, if you look at the data of keeper jumping, they only stay at home in the center about 2% of the time, which is to say almost never. So one might say, well, if you're the kicker, therefore, why don't you go center? And it turns out the kicks to the center are 7 percentage points more likely to succeed. So we ask, well, why do so few people do it? The reason is, if you kick upper left or upper right and the keeper makes a fantastic save, then he's a bigger hero than you, but you did nothing wrong. If, however, you kick center and the keeper manages somehow to stop it with a leg or an arm, then you must relocate your family to avoid assassination. And so it's private incentives versus group incentives. And so if it gets to be that situation, you should collectively encourage your kickers to kick center. Problem being, however, the more we talk about this, the more likely a keeper is to think about the kickers going center, and then they'll stay there and everyone will weep. So
So what do we conclude from this? We know statistically it's guaranteed to be the case that England would be involved in a penalty shootout in the World Cup. And almost certainly England will be eliminated by that process. But if they all kicked straight down the middle...
It would be entertaining if nothing else, yeah.
I don't think... are America and England liable to be up against each other?
I can't remember that bracket. I know we're seated. I think we're actually... Yeah. I hate to say it. Are we ahead of you? Maybe one slot behind. I think we're 14 FIFA ranking right now.
If you go back to 1950, I know. Beating and memorably. There was a question down here. A good question.
By the way, does anyone know where Robert Green is today? Was that the keeper?
The goalkeeper,
Has he been heard from?
Yeah. He was playing recently. I can't remember. Somebody will know.
For a high school or something?
Who is he playing for now? Queensborough Rangers. Just been promoted from the Championship to the Premiership. Yeah. So that's all right. Yeah. Okay. there was a question down there that I promised to come to. I know you've got... there was a question down there? No? Have you gone away? Okay. Or maybe there was somebody stormed out. Maybe I just didn't get to his question time. So you get another go.
Has thinking like a freak made you happy?
Ooh. Has thinking like a freak made you happy?
Does knowing the world... Is that a burden or an advantage?
That's a great question.
Good, snappy question. Yeah, that's an all-purpose question for anybody in any circle. I'll be using that for the rest of my career. But yeah. So, has becoming Prime Minister made you happy? Being the lead singer of One Direction, has that made you happy? This is fantastic. I'm going to come up and give you a big hug afterwards. So, has it made you happy? Come on. You have to go around the world, look at your data, people find holes in it. Can't make you happy, surely.
So, two things. One, you said understanding the world and thinking like a freak are two different things. So I understand that a few little tiny parts of the world, like baby names and cheating estate agents and things like that, I mean, I do. But in general, the world is still kind of a foggy mystery to me. But yeah, I'm super happy. I mean, I feel so lucky that these books have opened up the most amazing doors. And so the kinds of things I've been able to work on because of these books have been incredibly fun, and the people we get to meet. And I mean, one of the things we say in the book that we really encourage is like thinking like a child. And it's really easy to think like a child when you have 1,000 incredible opportunities laid out in front of you, and you know you make enough money from doing it that you don't worry about money, so you just do whatever is fun. So I think I'd say, other than while I'm doing book tours, I'm really happy.
Do you still teach regular classes at the university? Or are your classes all to do with, you know, hamburgers and penalty kicks, or do you do...
So I teach a regular PhD class, which is kind of how to think. Think about what makes good, you know, how to have a good career in academics.
I just wanted to get you answer that question briefly. Has it made you angry? You look reasonably happy.
I'm relatively happy, but I was relatively happy, you know. So my thing is, I always wondered about the impact of money on a person's life, because if you grow up without a lot of money, then you get some. You see how that affects you. So I still, to this day, gain joy from going to a supermarket and buying what I want instead of what's affordable. And I think that's a huge gain. Now, the thing that puzzles me and that bothers me is why when the rich countries in this world especially, but many, many other countries as well, why when the standard of living has increased so much across so many dimensions, why our overall happiness has not? And that, to me, is a riddle and a puzzle that a lot of people are working on, and no one has really come up with very satisfying answers. One of the biggest pieces of the riddle, one of the most depressing, is the fact that if you look at suicide, which we talk a little bit about in the new book, there's a relatively tiny amount of good research into suicide. We know very little, really, about why people commit suicide. One clue that's very distressing, you would think that suicide would be highest among those who are most desperate on one level or another, financially, politically, or whatnot. But it turns out it's the opposite. It's what one suicide scholar calls the no one left to blame theory of suicide, meaning if your life is demonstrably miserable in some way that may be repaired, you may make a lot of money, your political oppression may go away, then you have an optimism and a hope that does not lead to the kind of depression that leads to suicide. However, the highest suicide rates tend to be among the societies and the pockets of societies where well-being is the highest. And so that, to me, is a huge challenge to all of us, really, to try to understand better what does make us happy, or if we want a slightly less happy-sounding word, what makes us satisfied, what makes us derive the kind of pleasure that we think we should derive from having all this material wealth, all this relative prosperity. I think what it is that we used to think that humans were an absolute animal. If we had enough absolute money, food, shelter, and so on, like Maslow said, we could move on to self-actualization. I think what it turns out is that we're much more relative animals than we ever thought, and there's always someone who will make us feel like we need more. So that's kind of, I am happy, and I hope to remain happy, but in my work life, what I hope to address is why we are not all collectively more satisfied with what appears to be a bounty that has never existed in humankind.
I think I'm going to get this wording wrong, but I think it's not Yogi Bear, but Yogi Berra, the baseball guy, he put it, he's a very wise man with many of his sayings, but one is that if the world were perfect, it wouldn't be. Yeah. So if you got to a perfect world, I think he's put his finger on it. Look, we're running out of time. We've run out of time, in fact. So we've had lots of questions on the floor, but I just wanted to end with just asking you to include all the questions you've ever had, because you get a lot of correspondence, I know.
The best ever question?
Yeah, the best ever question you've had emailed to you or written to you or sent in. Oh. And can you say what the question is and answer it?
Sure. So I'll probably get in trouble for this, but let me do it anyway. So... the most interesting email I think I ever got came to me out of the blue. And the woman wrote me and she said, "Dear Professor Levitt, I'm a high-priced call girl in the city of Chicago. And I understand from a mutual acquaintance of ours that you've begun collecting data on prostitutes in the city of Chicago. I have a Palm Pilot that has all of the information on all the clients I've ever served Is that the kind of data that you're hoping to collect? So my first thought was I was indeed beginning to collect data at the very beginning stages of a project, of which maybe 10 or 12 of my colleagues were the only ones who were aware of the project. So I wondered which of my peers at the business school were spending $300 an hour with this young lady. But my response was quick. I wrote back, absolutely, that's the kind of data I'm trying to collect. I'd be delighted to get access to your Palm Pilot. And we decided to have brunch that Saturday. And it was, of course, somewhat awkward. I was married at that time and had four young children, and I had to explain to my wife why I was getting together with a prostitute that day. But I told her that, you know, honestly, she called me, not vice versa, and we're just going to talk about the day. Anyway, turned out to be a fascinating woman. To keep a long story short, she had a college degree. She was making $80,000 a year as a computer programmer. She decided that climbing the corporate ladder was a much less attractive life than becoming a prostitute, and she used her programming skills to build a web page. And within a few months, she was making a few $100,000 a year, working about 10 to 15 hours a week, and she couldn't have been happier about her situation. So anyway, it took about 10 minutes at this brunch to figure out how to hand over the data on the Palm Pilot, and there we were. And I already told you I'm pretty antisocial, and there I was. How was I going to make conversation with this woman for the next, you know, 45 minutes of brunch? So one virtue of having written Freakonomics is that we became business experts, and I had the opportunity to talk with lots of CEOs. And in the process, I had built the standard list of questions I would ask CEOs, and I figured I would just kill as much time as possible asking, pulling a page out of Dubner's book, which I would just ask question after question and make her answer those questions and maybe learn something along the way. And she gave me really great answers to the questions, I have to say, better than many of the CEOs gave me about their industries, until I finally stumped her, maybe on question six, which is, how do you set prices? Okay, and she gave me the same awful answers that I usually get from companies, and that, you know, economists, is one thing we know how to do is set prices, okay? But the answer she gave me was not the answer we like to hear. She kind of hemmed and hawed, and she said, well, I didn't know what to charge, so I looked on the internet, and I saw what some of the other women were charging, and, you know, there was a lot of different prices, but maybe 300 was about average, so I just figured I'd pick 300, too. Okay, so that irritated me, because we know how to set prices, and, you know, you got to figure out what your elasticity of demand is, and you need to figure out what your marginal cost is, and then it's very simple to know what price to charge. So I thought to myself, is there some way that maybe I could answer that question for her? And she had told me earlier in the conversation that she had a dedicated phone line that only her clients called her on. So I said, well, how do you feel when the phone rings? She said, well, I don't know. Sometimes I'm happy, but mostly I'm kind of indifferent. A lot of times I don't even pick up the phone when it rings. And I said, my God, you know, you're a local monopolist. You have a downward sloping demand curve. If you were optimizing and you could sell one more unit of your services at the same price as the last unit you supplied, you would obviously want to do it. Okay, she looked at me totally blankly, the way many of you are looking at me right now. But look, the point wasn't to maximize her profits. I was just trying to get access to her Palm Pilot. And so we parted ways, and I didn't think I'd see her again. But I teach at the University of Chicago to the undergrads, and one of the courses I teach is the economics of crime. And because I was starting to do this research on prostitution, I thought, well, I should add a lecture to my class. But it's not easy to write a good lecture. And I struggled for an hour or two trying to come up with something good to write about. And then I had this great idea. What if I call up my prostitute friend, and I have her come guest lecture at the university for me? Okay. And so I called her, and I asked her if she'd do it. And she said, oh, no, I would never do that. I'm a terrible public speaker. I'm a very private person. I just can't do that. But, you know, like journalists and economists, I sense that probably prostitutes, you just got to bargain to the right price, right? There's like no things they can't do. So I said to her, well, what if I paid you your hourly wage to teach my class? And she said, oh, I misunderstood. For my hourly wage, I'd be delighted to come down and teach your class. And so she came, and I have to say I'm a little bit embarrassed, but she gave a fabulous lecture. And indeed, a third of my students told me afterwards that it was the single best lecture that they sat in on in their 4 years at the University of Chicago, which is a sad statement about what me and my colleagues are doing in the classroom, but probably accurate. It was a great lecture. And then we did Q&A afterwards, and one of the students raised his hand and said, how much do you charge? And she said, $400 an hour. Okay? And I became absolutely livid, okay, because I thought that we had developed this relationship of trust, okay? And I knew she charged $300 an hour, but then she lies to the students, and she said she charges $400 an hour. Okay, and she's there for 2 hours. And it wouldn't be that bad if I could, say, charge it to a research grant and, you know, tell the National Science Foundation, well, you know, I'm too lazy to write my own lectures, so I hired a prostitute to come teach them, and I just need $800 for you to pay from the U.S. government, okay? So, no, this was $800 coming out of my pocket, and I was so incensed at the fact that she would lie about this and make me pay her an extra $200. And then the next student raised her hand, and she said, well, how did you decide how much to charge? And my new prostitute friend, I was sitting over there with Dubner, she had this big beaming smile on her face, and she smiled over at me, and she said, well, you know, the very first time that I was with Professor Levitt. She said, the very first time that I was with Professor Levitt, he convinced me that my services were far more valuable than $300 I started. And I raised my price to $400 an hour, and I tell you, it's the best business decision I ever made. So, look, I don't know if anything we said today is going to be useful to any of you, but we promise you, you send prostitutes our way, and we have a big impact on the bottom line.
Okay, well, that's the end. That's a very good note to end on. Well done, both of us, Stevens, Levitt and Dubner. Well done.
Thank you for listening. Well done. You can download more Intelligence Squared podcasts free on iTunes and SoundCloud. If you'd like to find out more about our events, sign up to our newsletter at intelligencesquared.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.